This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, August 13, 2004. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. The California Supreme Court invalidates more than 4,000 gay marriages. Bush aligns himself with anti-Castro Cuban Americans.
I was fighting against Fidel Castro. I was fighting against communists, and I keep fighting against communists and Fidel Castro.
And the government continues to label Muslim American men as terrorists. But first, these headlines.
I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. This morning, the U.S. military suspended its offensive against forces loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr in the city of Najaf. The move brought a temporary halt to fighting that has raged for 9 days and allowed Iraqi government officials to begin negotiations with the insurgents. The move comes as protests against the offensive sweep the region. The Associated Press reports that thousands of al-Sadr supporters demonstrated in Baghdad, Fallujah, and the largely Sunni town of Samarra. Al Jazeera reports that protesters in the southern town of Diwaniya attacked the local office of Prime Minister Iyad Alawi's political party. And more than 1,000 Sunni and Shia Muslims marched through the small town of Kut al-Hai to demand an end to the bloodletting. Meanwhile, thousands of Iranians participated in a state-sponsored protest in Tehran, and similar rallies are planned across the country. Today, the Australian Parliament passed legislation that enables a controversial free trade agreement with the United States to move forward. Erica Voles reports from Sydney.
Following months of wrangling between the coalition Conservative government and the Labor opposition, a deal was finally struck when the government agreed to opposition-sponsored amendments that aim to safeguard Australia's subsidised pharmaceutical benefits scheme. The passage of the deal was further helped along by amendments that protect current levels of Australian media content. However, the minor parties remained bitterly opposed to the deal. Lower House Greens MP Michael Organ, who opposed the FTA, said the deal could cost up to 50,000 manufacturing jobs alone.
There's still a lot of concern out there in the wider Australian community, amongst farmers, amongst people in the city, that there's a lot of negatives in this for Australians.
The deal still faces a further hurdle, with US trade officials warning that the legislation must be given a final check to ensure it abides by the spirit of the deal signed off by President Bush. Erica Voles in Sydney for Free Speech Radio News.
The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has confirmed that most of the benefits from President Bush's tax cuts have gone to millionaires. Mitch Jeserich reports from Washington, D.C.
About two-thirds of President Bush's tax benefits went to the top 20% household incomes, thus transferring the federal tax burden from the wealthiest to the so-called middle class, according to a report released today by the Congressional Budget Office. Taxpayers who earn over $1.2 million have seen their annual taxes lowered by almost $80,000. Meanwhile, households with incomes around $50,000 a year saw tax cuts of only $1,000, and the lowest 20% of wage earners saw their taxes decrease by just $250 a year. President Bush is calling on Congress to make these tax cuts permanent before they all expire by 2010. Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry is pledging more tax cuts for the middle class and raising taxes for people earning above $200,000 a year by returning to pre-2001 rates. Mitch Jeserich, Free Speech Radio News.
Nigerian groups are raising concern over a joint military exercise between the United States military and its Nigerian counterpart that's set to take place in the oil-rich Niger Delta region. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
According to General Alexander Ogomudia, Nigeria's Chief of Defense Staff, the joint military exercise will take place in the coastal city of Calabar in the Niger Delta. He did not, however, say when the exercise will take place. The Niger Delta is quite strategic to the United States. U.S. oil companies operating in the area have investments running into billions of dollars, and the region will account for a quarter of U.S. oil supplies in the coming years. Senior U.S. military officers have been holding talks with their Nigerian counterparts on how best to protect oil installations. Many people in the Niger Delta have expressed concern about growing U.S. military interest in the area. In recent years, Nigeria's military has been suppressing local agitation against oil companies. Communities want a share of oil revenue and a stoppage to environmental problems resulting from oil exploitation. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
Argentina's Senate has begun impeachment proceedings against a Supreme Court judge. He would be the fourth removed in a popular purge that could make it easier to prosecute former officers responsible for human rights abuses under Argentina's military dictatorship. Matt Goldin has more from Buenos Aires.
The Senate has begun proceedings to remove Supreme Court Judge Adolfo Vázquez, who was part of the former president Carlos Menem's so-called automatic majority. Judge Adolfo Vázquez said last night that he will not resign, accusing the government of wanting an addicted and submitted court. Since Néstor Kirchner assumed the presidency, three other Supreme Court judges have been impeached or resigned under pressure from the government. The removal of the judges is popular in Argentina. The Supreme Court is expected to rule soon on laws that protect from prosecution hundreds of officers involved in the violent repressions of dissidents 20 years ago. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Matt Goldin from Buenos Aires, Argentina.
And I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert for Free Speech Radio News.
Federal and local officials arrested two men in Albany, New York last week under suspicion of terrorism ties. Another New Yorker remains in jail after being picked up for videotaping financial buildings in North Carolina. These men are labeled terrorists by the media and some government officials before any conviction. Meanwhile, a public service announcement was released yesterday to bring awareness that Muslim American men are not terrorists. FSRN's Leon Caldwell files this report from WBAI in New York City.
I'm an African American. My forefathers overcame the trials of slavery.
I am Native American. I am a journalist, wife, and mother.
I'm of European heritage. One of my ancestors was a member of the Continental Congress.
A Hispanic woman wears a Muslim headscarf, a black man is clean cut and wears Western clothing, and a white man looks like an all-American.
And I am an American Muslim.
And I am an American Muslim.
And I am an American Muslim.
I am an American Muslim.
The Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE, released this public service announcement to radio and television stations around the country. The PSA is aired at a time when terrorist suspicion throughout the Muslim community is high. The terror alert level was raised at the end of July because American intelligence claimed they have some possible evidence of a terrorist attack in the United States. As a result, the government has stepped up its surveillance inside American borders as well. In May, Attorney General John Ashcroft and FBI Director Robert Mueller announced the National Criminal Intelligence Sharing Plan. It's a nationwide effort of local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies to capture terrorists within the United States. Officials not only look for suspicious activity, but they enter into Muslim communities and knock on doors and conduct interviews. Ibrahim Hooper, Communications Director for CARE.
The American Muslim community in general is being, I don't know if targeted is the word, but we're getting a tremendous number of reports of requests for voluntary interviews by FBI agents around the country.
Local and federal officials raided the Central Avenue Mosque in Albany last week. They arrested the co-founder and imam of the mosque, Yassin Arif, and pizza parlor owner Mohammed Hossein for conspiring to kill a Pakistani official in New York City and laundering $50,000 in payments for a missile. The FBI used a Pakistani informant who is trying to gain reprieve for a possible sentence for his crime of smuggling driver's licenses to catch Arif and Hossein, who they say have terrorist ties. Terence Kunlan, the attorney for the imam, Yassin Arif.
I know that the undercover lies for a living. I know he's quite adept at it, and I don't believe anything he says as far as I can throw my car. The whole thing smells like a rat. It really is just an evil scam that the government pulled on this guy.
Mike Kohlstedt, spokesperson for the Department of Justice, said the charges speak for themselves. He said a note was found at a terrorist training camp with Yassin Arif's name on it, with the word commander next to it. Kunlan, Arif's attorney, is aware of that note.
The U.S. attorney didn't have this sheet of paper, and the court was not able to see it. Obviously, the defense was not able to see it.
The two men were denied bail. Another New York man, Cameron Akhtar, of Middle Eastern descent, was arrested last month in North Carolina for filming financial buildings. On his tape were pictures of buildings and infrastructure in several U.S. cities. He has been labeled a terrorist by mainstream media. His brother, Ifran Akhtar, appeared on WBAI's morning show Wake Up Call and spoke about how the police have been handling his brother's case.
He has been giving totally negative statements about my brother from the very beginning, which I heard on the television.
Akhtar appeared in court on Tuesday and was charged with violating immigration law and is held without bail. Although Department of Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge did say he has no apparent terrorist ties. In addition to releasing the PSA, CARE teamed with the American Civil Liberties Union to offer free legal advice to any Muslim American who is approached by law enforcement in this latest round of interviews. For Free Speech Radio News in New York City, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The California Supreme Court ruled unanimously that San Francisco's Mayor Gavin Newsom overstepped his authority when he directed the city clerk to begin providing marriage licenses to same-sex couples 6 months ago. The justices also voted 5-2 in favor of invalidating the more than 4,000 licenses issued. Tori Taylor reports.
The decision denying San Francisco's right to issue the licenses didn't come as too much of a surprise, but the court was careful not to address the issue of constitutionality and whether the voter approved Proposition 22, that defines marriage in the state as between a man and woman, violates the state constitution's guarantee of equal protection under the law. Molly McKay is the Associate Executive Director of Equality California. She and her partner were among the first same-sex couples to get married on February 12th. McKay was hoping the judges would uphold the validity of the licenses, at least until the courts had had a chance to rule on the issue of constitutionality. But she acknowledges that civil rights aren't won overnight and says the decision has only strengthened her resolve to keep fighting.
We'll just continue to press forward. And no matter what, it was a win. It was a win because Mayor Newsom allowed us to show the real-life faces of the couples, and he allowed us to show our relationships and how long we'd been together and how many of us had children, and in a way that no litigation or no lawsuit or legislation ever could. So it's already been a win. This is just a temporary setback.
Mayor Gavin Newsom says that putting a face on the issue is exactly the reason the city chose to issue the licenses, rather than pursuing a more traditional course of changing the laws through legislation or the courts. The mayor says he respectfully disagrees with the Supreme Court's decision, but that he will abide by its ruling, while vowing to move ahead with the challenge. Newsom says he never expected an easy fight and brushes off the argument that his actions might have galvanized anti-gay rights groups, pointing to the ban on interracial marriage that faced similar hurdles before it was overturned. He says he has no regrets and wouldn't have done anything differently.
My only apology is we didn't succeed today, but my expectation is we're going to succeed tomorrow, next year, or the year after that. I mean, you wouldn't have the Voting Rights Act. You wouldn't have the Civil Rights Act. You wouldn't women voting in this country. People just gave up because they're worried about some reaction in some period of time. No, we're going to fight and to the end on this. These principles are significant. These principles are critical advancing this country and the core values in this country.
Jordan Lawrence, attorney for the ADF, or Alliance Defense Fund, says he thinks the majority of Americans have very different core values than the ones Mayor Newsom cites. And he promises that the ADF, which was founded to, quote, aggressively defend religious liberty, will continue the fight to prevent same-sex marriages.
This is not inevitable. The big picture is that whenever there have been state court decisions like in Alaska and Hawaii and Massachusetts finding a right to same-sex marriage, they have been either overturned by the voters, as in Hawaii and Alaska, or they're in the process of being overturned, as in Massachusetts. It is a vain hope to think that the courts, if they find a right to same-sex marriage, that that's interpretation of the Constitution will stand. The people will address it, and the people will define it the traditional way, in my opinion.
California State Attorney General Bill Lockyer argued on Lawrence's side before the Supreme Court, but not by choice. Lockyer supports gay marriage, but says his legal duty is to uphold the state's laws, whatever they might be. And he says the ruling was based simply on the letter of the law, a law that can be changed if that is the will of the people. Lockyer thinks that day is coming soon.
I think that there's been a history of discrimination in our country and many others against gays and lesbians that we're beginning to address forthrightly, and that's a healthy trend. So I'm sure that someday people will look back and wonder, what was this debate all about? I don't know that that day is 2004, but I think that someday there'll be a different legal status for relationships of this sort.
As for what's next, San Francisco is filing suit against the state, arguing Proposition 22 to be unconstitutional. The first briefs in that case will be filed in 2 weeks, and a decision from the Superior Court is expected sometime this winter. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tori Taylor in San Francisco.
Even as economic indicators demonstrated an increasingly volatile market, both Bush and Kerry focused on the economy as a top issue of their respective campaigns. Oil markets are tight as increased demand hits disruptions in supply. Anastasia Nezditskaya reports.
High oil prices, high gas prices, those put people in a very, very bad mood when they go to vote. So, you know, for President Bush, if the price of gas is still over $2 a gallon in November, that's going to be very, very bad for his reelection prospects.
That's one possible effect of recent drama in the oil market, according to economist Dean Baker at the Center for Economic Policy Research. After hovering in the $20 range for the past several decades, crude oil prices are hitting record highs this week, currently around $45 a barrel. Oil prices have been volatile but consistently high, even though OPEC and Saudi made assurances that they will raise production output to meet increased demand and counter possible disruptions in world supply. The U.S. economy is affected by oil prices, as shown in GDP growth, which declined 1.5% during the second quarter. Two-thirds of this decline is said to be due to higher energy prices. John Felmy, chief economist at the American Petroleum Institute, a trade group for the industry, describes the impact.
Higher energy prices are a direct drag on the economy. We've got both high petroleum prices and high natural gas prices. Higher energy prices are a drag on the economy because we have to ship more dollars abroad to pay for the petroleum. Our costs of production go up, so we're less competitive, and the purchasing power of consumers go down.
With the economy as a hot election topic, high oil prices that may stay high are certainly not welcomed by the incumbent candidate. With weak employment numbers, a budget deficit that is the largest in U.S. history, and a trade deficit also at record highs, the question is, how will high energy prices factor into people's lives? Baker says cheap oil is central to the American lifestyle.
There's this idea that, you know, we just have endless oil and we're just going to, you know, drive forever, whatever, you know, bigger and bigger and bigger cars. And a lot of people have adjusted to that lifestyle.
Several factors are contributing to the instability of the oil market, and hence that of the U.S. domestic and world economies. Felmy lists what situations the industry is watching.
We've got very strong demand for crude oil, primarily driven by Chinese demand and U.S. and other developed countries' demand because of growing economies. We've also got supply uncertainty. We've got concerns about the situation in Iraq, Nigeria, the upcoming referendum on President Chavez in Venezuela. So a whole myriad of supply and demand conditions have come together to drive up prices.
Possible future disruptions to world supply are reflected in oil prices. On the supply side, not only is U.S. consumption growing at a rapid pace, predictions of the world oil demand estimate were raised recently as growth from China and India outpaced previous predictions for 2004 and 2005. Baker says that these growing economies have been neglected in previous oil demand assessments.
We've seen really strong, impressive growth in those countries in recent years. But on the other hand, that should not have been a surprise in 2004. Now, maybe if we were sitting around in 1994, it'd be a surprise that these countries would see strong growth, you know, sustained over a decade as they have. But, you know, a year ago, it shouldn't have been that much of a surprise to someone that China would grow 7, 8, or 9%.
With surprising demand growth and supply volatility, is there enough oil to go around? At a cost, according to Felmy.
There's adequate supply to meet that demand, but it's at very high prices. The key is, will demand continue to grow at these high prices? Will the economies of the world, the U.S. economy, the Chinese economy, continue to grow? And if they do, demand for petroleum tends to grow with it.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnizditska in collaboration with Jenny Johnson.
President Bush recently signed a law limiting Cuban Americans' visits to Cuba to once every 3 years. Travel by Cubans to their homeland opened in 1978 during the Carter years. In the past, the Cuban vote in Florida has historically gone to hardline Republicans who have been tough on Fidel Castro's regime. At the same time, Florida's Cuban population has annually ferried money and medicines to their families on the island. But now President Bush has aligned himself with a faction in the Cuban-American community who are willing to sacrifice their families back home in order to send Fidel a message. From Tampa, Mark Antokas has the story.
Mara Barrios is the Assistant Director of Latin American and Caribbean Studies at USF. She believes that the Bush administration's family travel restrictions to Cuba hits to the heart of Cuban nationalism and family relationships, and says that the new generation of Cubans are more outspoken against the current administration's policies.
Fact is that we're very diverse. There are people who are extreme right, who supported, actually gave Bush all of those ideas about how to punish their own people and their own families. And then there are many moderate Cuban groups that have organized in the last 10 years who are anti-embargo, who are against these travel restrictions. And then there are these new people who are just kind of spontaneously going out on the street and protesting.
While the Cuban community in Miami are reported to have given the Bush administration new ideas on fighting Castro, there are conflicting views. Standing in front of the La Terracita grocery in the Cuban neighborhood of West Tampa, I asked the residents their thoughts.
No, your bus for me no good.
You have family in Cuba?
Sí, tengo mi familia en Cuba y no puedo visitar a Cuba ni me la dejan traer tampoco para acá. Claro que no es bueno para mí. I vote for Kerry.
If Fidel Castro is number one terrorist in the world.
Yo prefiero a Kerry. Kerry.
I'm living here for 20, 30 years already, and I still have Cuban in my heart.
Don't you think that that we should open up the borders?
No. I want he tiny a little bit more. That's what I want from Bush, and I'm going to vote for Bush. So I want Fidel out. 100 times I'm hanging.
Betty Castor is a Democratic candidate for Bob Graham's Senate seat. Castor is opposed to the Bush law.
I'm totally opposed to what the president has suggested. I think families in this country need to be able to visit their families in Cuba. We're a democracy. If we want to spread democratic values, we all allow travel, but especially humanitarian travel, especially family travel. So I'm very much opposed to this idea that families can travel only once every 3 years. And we have redefined the family now, so we can't go see aunts and uncles. I think that's absurd.
Juan Sosa went to school with and was boyhood friends with Castro. In 1961, Sosa participated in the covert, CIA-backed Bay of Pigs invasion with the Cuban 2506 Brigade.
I was fighting against Fidel Castro. I was fighting against communists, and I keep fighting against communists and Fidel Castro.
How did the middle class feel about Castro taking over?
The middle class are all in Miami. He finished with the middle class and then he took everything out of the poor people. Now he owns the entire island.
While George W. Bush may have made a quantitative decision regarding Cuban travel restrictions, playing to Miami's hardliners, the vote is still in question when it comes to Florida's Cuban community as a whole. Many Cuban Americans living in Florida see themselves as a lifeline of money and medicines to their families. For Free Speech Radio News, from WMNF in Tampa, this is Mark Antokas.
Nationwide, corrections officials are returning to old ideas to reduce booming prison populations. A progressive philosophy of inmate rehabilitation is set to take effect in 2 Maryland prisons and eventually the entire state. Inmates will gain better access to programs that will benefit them upon return to the community, including education, substance abuse treatment, mental health, and reentry support services. FSRN's Jenny Johnson has the story.
Jamisha Rodriguez's experience while in prison is just the sort Maryland prison officials say they would like to emulate for every possible inmate.
I started in the GED program, and I received my GED, and then I went and did the employment readiness, and then after that, I went to the computer repair, and then when I completed that, I did the business data processing class, and then after that, I went and became a clerk for the computer repair class, and it just has opened a lot of doors, and it's just been a lot of opportunities that I didn't realize I was even capable of doing myself. It's give me confidence and, well, it would help me from not coming back or going to what I was doing.
Maryland officials are realizing that with an increasing inmate population, according to Richard Rosenblatt, the department's assistant secretary of treatment services, they are going to get swallowed if meaningful action is not taken to reduce recidivism.
If the programs aren't going to be in the community, if they aren't going to be in the schools, if they aren't going to be in juvenile services, then we're going to have to look at those who are coming back in after having been with us. It's the only way we can control the front door and control the ever-expanding inmate population.
Restart, Reentry Enforcement Services Targeting Addiction, Rehabilitation, and Treatment is carefully not referred to as a program by its proponents. To them, it is a much deeper philosophic shift to the way correction systems are currently run.
What is it that works with inmates? We have been designing our approaches based on the research that works.
The Secretary of the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services, Marianne Saar, who spearheaded the effort to bring more rehabilitative services to the state's prisons, is determined that Restart will meet its goals to reduce recidivism, a rate that has been as high as 37%.
We want to make sure that the people that come through this system, the majority of them never come back. The other good part is we will then have bed space for those who need to stay for a long time. And there are those also. I mean, not everybody is going to make it out there. The other reduction you're going to see when this works, not if it works, but when it works, is the construction, prison construction, which is extremely expensive.
Studies are concluding that rehabilitation should become a basic principle of corrections because both society and offenders benefit when offenders are prepared to reenter society. Restart promises to bring in significant resources for programs that have shrunk due to budget cuts, such as at the women's prison, set to be one of the first beneficiaries of the increased funds. The rate of female incarceration has grown at a faster pace nationally, an average of 1.5 times higher than that of men, and overwhelmingly for drug-related crimes. One of the only drug programs in the prison, Women's Intensive Treatment, currently has a capacity of 50 participants for the 9-month duration of the program, while the prison's entire population at any one time is 900. Angela Watkins describes the need she has seen.
They need more drug classes. They used to have understanding substance abuse, but they stopped that. And I've been here 2.5 years, and I've seen women who've come in 3 and 4 and 5 times coming back and forth to prison. It's like you're doing life, but you're doing an installment plan.
Angela and Jamisha will complete their sentences in several more months, and in the meantime, plan to utilize all the classes available in preparation for their returns.
Yes, what else am I doing now? What I'm going to do now? Yeah. You go to the next thing, yeah. The next thing. And then I'm like, when I get out here, I'm going to college. I'm not stopping. I'm going to college when
I
leave.
Me too. Yeah. There's just so many things I want to do now. It just opens the door to a whole new world.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Jenny Johnson.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in LA, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Millen, and Eric Klein. Special thanks to Transbay for web services.